for no apparent reason, I have selected tonight to talk, instead of on the resurrection of Christ, upon the subject of marriage and the home. I'm persuaded, brethren, that one of the most neglected areas of our life is concentration in our lives as a home and as a family unit. There's a great deal of preaching that is done on the home, and yet there's a great deal that needs to be done. I'm persuaded that if everyone was like Noah in the Bible, that is, if everyone just saved his family, then everyone would be saved, now wouldn't they? You know, did you ever think about that? That Noah labored for many years and was a preacher of righteousness. But all that were saved was Mrs. Noah and the three little Noahs and their wives. And yet, if everybody did that, then everybody would be saved. You think about the great King David. Here was one of the greatest men of antiquity. Here was one of the greatest men that God ever made. A man discussed and described and defined as a man after God's own heart. But what was it that caused him problems? What was it that brought him shame and humiliation and degradation? What was it that caused him affliction? What was it that caused him trouble and kept him perhaps from being able to do many of the things he would like to have done from a positive standpoint? It was trouble in his own family. It was sin within the members of his own family that caused such heartache and sorrow unto King David. And you can read all about it in the book of 2 Samuel. And so it's necessary, it's important that we address the subject of marriage and the home. Now, many times when we address this subject, people think, well, we're taking a night out, you know, and we're not going to preach the gospel tonight. That we're going to preach on marriage in the home, and we're really getting away from the Bible. Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, there are three great institutions that God has created. God has given us the civil government. He has authorized civil government to rule in society. And the Bible tells us that the civil authorities are the ministers of God for our benefit and for our blessing. In the spiritual realm, God has instituted, God has inaugurated the church. It is the highest and finest and noblest of all of God's creations. That is His spiritual body, that institution, that organism, if you will, purchased by the precious blood of Christ, and that is the church of the Lord. But then He has also given us, not only in the civil realm, not only in the spiritual realm, but thirdly in the domestic realm, God has given us the home or the family unit. The home and the family is not a relationship that has grown out of experimentation by man himself. No, the Bible tells us that when God created man in the Garden of Eden, that then He saw it was not good for man to be alone, and that He created Eve and brought her unto the man. Now we will notice that when God brought Eve unto the man, that He brought a woman unto the man. He did not bring two women. He did not bring three or more, and He did not bring another man. He brought a woman unto the man. And so God established the family relationship. But before we get into the home itself and into that family relationship, there are a number of factors that a person needs to consider before he ever gets married. And I hope you young people will think on some of these areas and some of these lines of thought before you ever marry. Now, for a lot of us, it's too late. You've done missed it, perhaps. But for some of you, there is still time to think, and I mean seriously to reflect, upon certain areas. Number one, I think you need to give careful consideration to the religion or the lack thereof of the person with whom you may spend the rest of your life. Now, I do not believe that the Bible teaches that it is a sin per se, that is, in and of itself, it is a sin to marry a non-Christian. I'm not persuaded the Bible teaches that. It may be such due to a circumstance or particular situation. But I do say that you need to give careful heed unto the religion, or as I said, the lack thereof, of the person with whom you may spend the rest of your life. Someone has said, if you marry a child of the devil, you may have trouble with your father-in-law. Have you ever thought about that? Well, then, understand this, that in religion, if you don't think about it, there are going to be some problems you're going to face. Number one, you're going to have a problem just after you're married, you're going to have a problem of attendance. Now, you just ask some people in the church that have married those outside of the faith and those that don't have any spiritual bone at all within their spiritual man. People that are not religious, they are those that will hinder you from perhaps being faithful in attendance. And they will make it hard for you. And now you think that that's not a problem. And you say, well, that'll just be a problem maybe three times a week and maybe during the time of a gospel meeting. But it is a thing that will color and affect nearly every aspect of your life if, and I'm assuming a big if here, if I assume you are a Christian and that you want to serve the Lord, that you want to go to heaven when you die, you're going to have a problem with attendance often as not when you marry out of the faith. When you marry someone that doesn't want to get up, doesn't want to get the children ready. And oh, is it a problem when the little children start saying, why do I have to go? Daddy doesn't go. Nearly every 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old kid has said words to that effect when one of the parents will not go to worship. And so it becomes a problem, an attendance problem. It's a difficult thing to deal with, and it may sap your spiritual strength. Secondly, you're going to have a problem that we might just add in certain other areas. For example, in your giving. Now, you see, giving of your means is something that I am going to assume that you take a special notice of as a Christian. Now, to the average person, they think that when you pass the basket or pass the trays, you know, at church, well, it's just a token thing. You know, like someone coming around with one of those charities to your home, and, you know, you reach down and you maybe find a dollar of change or something, you plunk it in, and say, well, I did my deed, you know, I didn't want to be embarrassed. And I didn't want to give a bunch, but I had to give them something, you know. Now, that's the way most people feel about going to church. And you see, let's just assume now that you're a Christian. You know you're supposed to give as you purposed and as you've been prospered. Now, let's suppose, men, you marry a lady who's not a Christian. And let's just use a nominal figure out here and suppose that you're doing well, or we'll just pick a figure out. Let's just say $20 even a week. Now, you know, to a non-Christian, that's almost absurd. $20 a week? You know, to support that long-winded preacher and that bunch of hypocrites down there at Knowwood? I mean, you tell me. And so that's the way they look at it. And you mean you're going to give $20 a week? Why, and I can't have a new dress and purse and, of course, shoes to match? Now, I quit buying my wife a dress, you know, every once in a while because it costs me more to outfit the rest of it. And so anyway, I'll tell you, now, they're not going to understand that. And a man, you know, is not going to understand why, ladies, that you feel like you can give maybe a prodigious sum of money, whatever it might be, and, you know, maybe he wants a new shotgun for some hunting, and maybe he wants some new fishing equipment or a new boat, and man, what you're giving every week would make a good payment for a good bass boat. And see, you're going to have those problems. They're going to be there with you when you marry outside of the faith. Now, let me tell you something else. You're also going to have the problem of a worldly influence upon your children. I know numbers of times, not a great number of times, but given the numbers of times I've been in people's homes and meetings, that I've had maybe a lady be getting supper ready and open up a refrigerator door and there would be beer sitting in there. And she'd be embarrassed. And her husband's not a Christian. And there's the beer he drinks. And that's something that's around the children, you see. And you have that problem of worldly influence. And maybe your husband doesn't understand why you can't go to some of the places of entertainment and of amusement. And you know, when you're married, you're the only date he can get, or ought to have, you see. And so that's going to be a problem. It's going to be a problem of influence. And think about it. If evil companionships corrupt good morals, then why won't it work inside of marriage in the most intimate of all human relationships? Certainly it will be so. And so you marry out of the faith, you're going to have a problem of worldly influence. But then secondly, you need to consider the character of the person with whom you may spend the rest of your life. Now, you know, there are a lot of things that you can't know about a person until you live with them for a while. Just a whole lot of things that you can't know about them. Now, I will tell you this, though, that there are some things you can know and that will save you a lot of heartache and a lot of misery. Now, there are some things, as I said, you can't know, but there are a few key areas that you can observe if you're not bothered and blinded by love, you know. Some of you get so much in love, you're just blind to everything. Everybody says, you know, love is blind, love is, you know, marriage is a wonderful institution. And somebody else said, yes, but who wants to be an institution for the blind all their life? But I don't know. Maybe that's the way some are. But, you know, you have to consider the character of that person. Number one, here's something you can know about a person, and that is, are they honest? Now, is the person basically, simply, are they honest? You know, the Bible teaches we ought to provide things honest in the sight of all men. And you know, this is a thing that will go a long way toward producing happiness or engendering a great deal of unhappiness. You can watch and observe the honesty of a person or the lack of integrity in a person before you ever marry them. Now, if you will be observant, you can save yourself a lot of heartache and a lot of misery. Let me tell you something, ladies. If he'll lie to you now, he'll lie to you later. Just mark that down. And if she will tell lies with you, then she will do it after she marries you. If he'll tell a lie to your parents and to his parents about where he's taking you and what you're going to be doing, just because he wants to do something badly enough, don't you think that after he marries you, if there's something he wants to do and somebody he wants to be with, that he'll lie to get to do it? You can observe the character trait of honesty. That's something you cannot know. Now, a lot of things you can't know, you know. My wife did not know that I left books between the sofa and the coffee table on the floor. And I told her they were just little footnats, you know. She said, but open and the pages folded and underlined as well. She didn't know that before, see. Those are the little things you can't know. But there's some things you can know. There's something else you can know and you need to watch for. Save yourself a lot of misery. And that is the character of the jealous heart. You know what the Bible says? The Bible says that wrath is cruel and anger is outrageous. But who is able to stand before jealousy? The Bible asked that question. You know, in Shakespeare, in Act 3, Scene 3 of the play Othello said, Shakespeare said that jealousy is the green-eyed monster. And Iago tried to create that, you know, concerning Desdemona and Othello, and he did it. It's the green-eyed monster. But a wiser than Shakespeare said that jealousy is as cruel as the grave. Song of Solomon, chapter 8, and verse 6. And jealousy is so destructive. We oftentimes think that jealousy is cute and that it makes a person, you know, feel like somebody cares about you. Now, let me tell you, this characteristic of extreme jealousy betrays a sense of insecurity, a lack of a healthy self-image and self-esteem, and it is a characteristic that will cause untold heartache in a marriage. I know a couple, a lovely young couple, and the woman was just, both of them Christians, but the woman was extremely jealous. Everybody thought it was so neat because how she loved him, you know. And then they got married. And so One day he came home from work, and it was, he got home on the second shift, is getting off work about 11:30 or midnight, and he came home, and the next morning she was going to get up and run to the store real quick, get some milk or something before breakfast, before he got up to get a breakfast for him, and she got out of their car, and in the back seat, the floorboard back yonder, was a red scarf. And oh, that's all she saw for several days, was red. And she come storming in the house like a Nazi division. And she bangs through the door and said, "Where'd this come from?" And he said the guiltiest thing he could have said. He said, "I don't know." I'll tell you, if you ever get faced like that, make up something. It sounds better than that. And so, now, to tell you how I know all of this, because of the fact that she gets on the phone a boo-hooing and a crying and a caterwauling and everything is terrible. "Oh, my husband, you know. And he's there and everybody knows that he's a good fellow and wouldn't do something like that. And yet she wouldn't make up a tale like that. And he says, "I don't know." And she says, "The dirty scoundrel." And about 2 or 3 days later, one of the neighbor ladies comes over and says, "When we went shopping the other day, did I leave my red scarf in your car?" Jealousy has scarred that relationship. Scarred it. Now, I'll tell you why. You have to be careful that you don't marry somebody that is so insanely, inanely jealous. Watch out for that. That's something you can know. Now, you don't know if she wears a shower cap to sleep in at night. You shouldn't ought to know that. But I tell you what, you can know. And a woman ever did that, a man ought to put on goggles and wear them to bed. But you can know this. Now, thirdly, you need to consider the attitude, the general attitude of the person with whom you may spend the rest of your life. And I mean by that attitude, are they generally pleasant? Or are they people given to extreme swings in moods? This will only intensify after marriage. What's the attitude toward little children? Now, you think about this. These are things you can know. Observe them around little children here at services. Observe them around elderly people. What's their attitude toward older people? What's their attitude towards their mom and dad, toward their relatives? You know, it sounds hip, you know, and maybe it sounds neat and cool to some young people to have a young person come out talking about their old man and their old lady, you know? And his stupid uncles and aunts, you know. And all that, you know, may sound really good and really cool when you're maybe trying to get your wings and trying to establish your independence. But I tell you, it's not so funny when all of a sudden your mother someday becomes the old lady. And you know, if you talk about his mama that way, he'll talk about your mama that way. That's right. Just look at the attitude the individual has. What's the attitude toward money? Are they responsible with it? Or do they cast it freely to the wind, trying to impress you with spendthrift habits? And they lack frugality, lack the ability to pinch pennies and to be a saving and to be watchful concerning a budget. Oh, it's a big thing, you know, to spend a lot of money on a girl and impress her that way. But if a girl's what she ought to be, she'll know that that kind of a thing can't keep up forever. Like our U.S. government's finding out. You just can't keep doing that forever. And so look at the attitude of the person you're going to spend the rest of your life with. What's the attitude toward little kids? What's the attitude toward the doddering elderly person? What's the attitude toward their relatives? What's the attitude toward money? What's their attitude toward four-letter words like work and soap? You know, these are things that you need to observe of the person and about them before you ever marry. But let's think now about marriage itself. Let us just look briefly at what are the purposes of marriage. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I recognize that I'm going to lose maybe some of the young people when I give this first of the purposes of marriage. I know when I was a boy growing up and we had brethren come and preach, and Brother Jim Cope used to come up to Peoria where I was raised and went to church, and they come up and they talk about marriage, and this one of the purposes of marriage, they put it on the board, and I thought, man who needs it. And you know, one of the purposes of marriage, the Bible says it's not good for a man to be alone. And so marriage is for companionship. I didn't think that needed any of that. I mean, I could get together 20 guys any Saturday morning and play ball. We could always find and hunt and peck and get into all kinds of mischief with any number of guys and maybe even a few girls to make it interesting. Why, companionship? Marry for companionship? Man, I didn't need that. Well, let me tell you, if your wife is not your best friend, if your husband is not your best friend, within a certain area, of course, of understanding, we all have outlets and different friends and things of that kind. But if they're not a good friend, you're not going to long be lovers. Not going to long be lovers. The Bible says that the purpose of marriage, one of the purposes is for companionship. To be a companion. Someone you can talk to, someone that you can relate to, someone that you can fulfill and share all of your needs and all of your cares and all of your joys and all of your sorrows, and they'll be there. They'll be there responsive, kind, considerate. They'll be there forgiving. They'll be there uplifting. They'll be there strengthening. They'll be there encouraging. That's what a companion is all about. And then, of course, marriage has as one of its purposes the procreation and the propagation of the human species. You know, the Bible teaches that as arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. The Bible says in Psalm 128 and verse 3, that thy wife shall be as a fruitful vine by the sides of thine house, thy children like olive plants round about thy table. How do we decorate our homes? Well, you know, across the mantle sometimes we'll run greenery, little vines, and we grow things in the house, don't we, plants? Why, we have all kinds of things for decoration, whether real or artificial, don't we? And because we know that it's decorative, and even on our table at home, you know, you'll have maybe a candle, you have all that greenery around it, and it's all plastic. You know, it's something only a plastic cow could eat. But at any rate, we have that kind of a thing. And so the Bible says that that'll be the beauty and the splendor of marriage is for the propagation of the human species. And then thirdly, another purpose of marriage, which is usually overlooked and not taught by mothers and fathers, and yet ought to be and needs to be, is the purpose a marriage has of avoiding immorality. The Bible teaches that a purpose of marriage is to avoid sexual immorality. Now, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1, the Apostle Paul said, "Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." Now, that simply means, considering what you all have written to me, Paul said, it's good not to be married. Someone said, "See, now Paul was a male chauvinist. Paul said it's not good to be married." Now, you don't understand something, friend. In 1 Corinthians 7, 1, Paul said, "Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me." Do you know what they wrote to Paul? I don't either. See? But as long as you don't know that, then you don't understand the basis on which Paul makes his comment. Paul said, "In view of what you've written to me, it'd be best for you not to marry right now." Nevertheless, verse 2, "To avoid fornication," or as some translations say, "to avoid sexual immorality, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband." And that's what the book says. The Bible teaches that one of the purposes of marriage is for the fulfillment, to satisfy and to gratify the sexual urge that God has placed within the man and the woman. Now, you know, the sexual nature of the man and woman is, in one sense of the word, related like unto fire, we might say. You know, fire is a beautiful thing. Fire is lovely, crackling there in the grate in the cold wintertime. and it just has kind of a beauty to it. Even when the furnace is running, we like to have the old fireplace there, you know, and it's just a beautiful thing. And we enjoy fire in a crisp October on a Friday night before a big football game. Don't you love it? And maybe on a hayrack ride, and you come back, you know, and boy, there's boards all stacked up, you know, you got to get a stick 19 feet long to get near to do your hot dog because it's so hot. Man, I love it like that, don't you? That's wonderful. But, you know, fire as good as it is, suppose you were coming home tonight and you saw the illumination against the horizon and the red flickering lights of the fire engines, and you drew clearer to home, nearer to home, and oh, it was your house on fire. Terrible sight. I watched a deacon's home in Alabama burn to the ground one day. Had to hold his wife, keep her from rushing into that house. I was the first one there, and she came squalling in there from work, from not far there, and had to grab a hold of her, keep her from dashing in there. And the flames began to lick and to crackle, and things burst and popped, and firemen there with axes and going through the roof. It was terrible. Fire was ugly, evil, dirty and bad. Condemn all fire? No. Out of its place, it's harmful. And so it is with regard to sexual immorality. This is the purpose of marriage. And this is a fact that is not taught even from the pulpit, but it's not really the place of gospel preaching per se. And though it's part of the Bible, it ought to be taught, but it's a part of the responsibility of the home. And it's something that mothers need to be teaching their children. Fathers need to be teaching their children. Because we raise up many children that are unprepared for their sexual role and relationship in marriage, because they're raised up and they're taught that it's all evil, ugly, dirty, and bad. There's nothing good or positive or beautiful or lovely about it. And then all of a sudden they get married and sign a piece of paper, and then there's problems in the marriage. And it's because we've not been taught the difference. We know when fire is good and we know when fire is bad. And so it is with regard to the man and the woman. This is the kind of preaching you say doesn't need to be done from the pulpit. Well, it's done in the Bible. And it can be done with discreet, with tactness, but it ought to be done in the home then, if it ought not to be done from here. And are you doing it? But then, finally, the Bible teaches that the husband and the wife have as their one of their purposes, one to another, there to be a help that is fitable, that is fitting or suitable, one unto the other. The Bible says, I will make an help meet for him, one suitable to him. And the husband and the wife are to help and assist one another, and thus that is the purpose of marriage. What are some of the mutual duties and responsibilities of both the husband and the wife? What things are equally incumbent upon both the husband and the wife? Well, number one, both the husband and the wife have as their mutual duty, equally incumbent upon both of them, that they love one another. You say that they wouldn't be married if they didn't love each other. Oh, yeah. A lot of marriages today. No love. No love there. Just no love. That's why the Bible says husbands love your wives, and it says aged women teach younger women to love their husbands, to love their children. You know, that's something that you may have to learn. And it's a responsibility of both the husband and the wife. I don't want you to be like that fellow down in Alabama was that I talked to. Good friend of mine, we were talking, and his wife said, Brother Hafler said, Billy never tells me he loves me anymore. And he said, I told her, Brother Hafler, 20 years ago when we married, I told her I loved her, and if I ever changed my mind, she'd be the first one to know. Now, if you love one another, you've got to say so. You've got to say so. You've got to express that love one to the other. Husband and wife, say so. You're supposed to express that love. And you know, marriage is not going to be all a nice Friday night date. It's not going to all be a clean car and a nice place maybe to go to eat. It's not going to be all of that, you know, nice hairdo and everything in place. Sometimes marriage is cold and dreary and overcast Monday mornings. Sometimes marriage is when you come in the morning and the wife is sitting there, you know, and her face is in on the dresser and her hair is all wired for sound. And I'll tell you, now we're talking love. This is heavy stuff. I tell you. And we've got to be able to express that love, to be able to show it, to be able to say it. That's what the book of God teaches. And we are to express that love not only to husband and wife and to show that love and things that we do and how we direct our life. But then, secondly, another mutual responsibility of both the husband and the wife is to submit themselves. You say, I thought this was a duty that the woman had. I thought, Damas, you got this wrong. I thought this was only the duty of a woman. Well, you know what the Bible teaches? The Bible teaches, husbands, love your wives even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. Is that submission? You betcha. You betcha. And all of these women livers have got it all wrong in the first place. You see, my wife doesn't want to be my equal. Well, she doesn't want to be brought down off that pedestal that I think she belongs on. And that's the truth. And if every man would love his wife as Christ loved the church, you wouldn't find any, and I never have seen one of these women, you know, walking around and doing all that and crying for all this equality stuff that I'd want to touch with a 10-foot pole anyway. Some of them, you feel like you'd like to take a stick and jab them in the ribs when you get close. But the idea is that the husband and wife are both to be submissive. And you know, that kind of submission of a man's part is based upon the fact that he loves his wife. Do you know how Christ loved the church? He gave himself sacrificially for it. That's submission. And that's how I am to love my wife and how I'm to be the head of my wife. Submissively, not dictatorially. Now, then the husband and the wife have responsibility in their marital realm, and we get back to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where that we see that their relationship in the physical realm is not to be used as a club to punish, nor as a bouquet to reward. The Bible says to avoid fornication, 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 2, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Let the husband, verse 3, render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife, verse 4, hath not power of her own body, but the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. Now watch verse 5. Defraud, or that is, don't cheat or deprive one another. Defraud ye not one the other. That is, in your physical sexual relationship, except it be with consent, that's mutual consent, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency, or that is your lack of self-control. If you abstain from your sexual relationship, it's only to be for a limited time and for spiritual purposes. It's not to be extensive in time, because Satan will tempt you for your lack of self-control. And there is submission. You say, well, what's to keep a man or a woman from abusing a passage like this? The wife hath not power of her own body. I'll tell you what will keep that from happening is this love right up here. You know, something you love, you're not going to abuse. Something that you love, you're not going to cause pain to, you see. And so then, with that right kind of love, and the husband and the wife submitting themselves, recognizing they don't belong to themselves, but one to the other, and that rule by love will cure an awful, awful lot of problems. It'll certainly do it. And then, I can't think of anything better than the golden rule. You know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The golden rule is probably a thing that's neglected in the home, and Matthew 7:12 is a great principle for the home. Great principle for the kingdom, but a great principle for the home also. You know, we need to abstain from criticizing the kinfolks of the wife or of the husband unduly and unfairly. We need to surprise one another maybe with a gift. And you remember how it used to be, ladies, when you were trying to get that man to marry you, or at least to ask you or something, and you had him to come over and you fix the dinner and you find out what he liked to eat and you'd have what he liked to eat? You ever do that anymore? And you remember, gentlemen, how that when you see her, you say, "Oh, what a beautiful dress." And, oh, you just, "Oh, your hair looks great," you know. And you didn't maybe mean it, but you thought you ought to say it so she'd like you. Now, do you ever say it? Do you ever say it? Let me tell you something, see. I haven't been married as long as some of you, but we've been married about 18 years. It just seems that long sometimes. But you know, my wife has fried a lot of chicken for me, but every time she fries it, I tell her it's better than the last time. She almost believes it, yeah. But that's what we got to do, you know. And see, you're together and you see one another. And, you know, she's seen and pressed all my clothes. She still tells me that, you know, from the neck down, not bad looking, you know. And worn the same outfit 10,000 times. She's seen me, you know. But that's what you have to do. That's what you need to be doing in your marriage. And that's why maybe some of you don't have a happy marriage. And I'll tell you another thing you need to be able to do. That is to confess your faults and forgive. Now, which is easiest for you to do? Is it easy for you to confess? Say, "Well, I'm not too good at confessing." Well, can you forgive? And I'll tell you a reason a lot of marriages are in trouble tonight. It is because of the fact that you've got some stubborn, proud, arrogant, vain man that is unwilling, because of a false sense of macho and masculinity, who thinks that he would be a shriveling, sniveling coward if he was to ever say, "I was wrong." And oh, the happiness he is missing, the joy and the pleasure and the love that he's missing. Because the dumb, ignorant brute is too proud and too stubborn to say, "Honey, I was wrong and I'm sorry, will you forgive me?" Those little words would just clear out an awful lot of cobwebs, I'll tell you. They'd kill an awful lot of spiders that form the cobwebs in that marriage. We need to learn to do that. And then we need to learn, when we say we're forgiven, to forgive and forget. How would you like it if every time, you know, you confess to the Lord and you say, "Well, Lord, I'm sorry, please forgive me." And the Lord said, "That's the 10,000th time in 10 years, Larry." Would you like that kind of forgiveness? And, you know, throwing it up. You know, someone has said, the only thing worse than having hash for dinner is having hash rehashed. I'm afraid that's true with regard to our mistakes sometimes too, isn't it? Now, what are some duties of the husband? What are some duties of the husband? Well, the husband ought to direct his wife. He ought to be the head of his house. These are duties now that are incumbent upon the man. He's to direct his house, but as I said, it is not a dictatorial direction. It is one spawned and begotten of love. And he's considering that body as though it were of his own. You know, the Bible teaches that the husband is to love his wife as his own body. You know, in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 28, "Sought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself, as no man ever yet hated his own flesh." What do you do with your body? Do you hate it? No, you take care of it. You groom it, you clean it, you treat it right. And if it's, you know, if it's wounded, you know, you take it. I burned my hand about a week before Christmas. Really did an A number one job on it. And it was a grisly looking, it looked like something cooking up at Ponderosa on the grill. I mean, it was, It was a mess. And you know, I took care of that. I said, don't leave me now, Aunt. I'll take care of the rest of my days. And I was so good to it. I mean, I kept it in a little big, quiet, big boxing glove, you know, and I just held that thing up, and I just cooed at it and just talked to it so sweet and good. And I milked that thing for sympathy at church. I was actually ashamed, Weldon. It just got out of hand. It was well 2 weeks before I took the bandages off. But, now, you know, it's something about your body. You're going to take care of your body. And so the Bible says that that's where a husband ought to care for his wife. And a lot of husbands have this idea. They have the idea that to direct their wives, they've got to be Adolf Hitler. And that's their idea of being the head of the house. That's not the Bible's idea. And you know, the Lord is the head of the church. We're to be the head as the Lord is. But the Lord is not one that gives orders that will harm or hurt or be to the detriment of the church, but for its upbuilding and for its prosperity, for its happiness and for its growth. And that's the way a man ought to direct his house. You know, the Bible says that he's to nourish and to cherish it. That's the way that a man is to care for his wife. He is to nourish and cherish his wife. Those are tender words, and they don't just apply to newlyweds. You know, sometimes people say, you know, it's a dog's life. Well, you ever see a man come home from work? You know, a dog comes running out to greet him, you know. And, he speaks so chummy to the dog, and he pets and he rubs it back, and he throws a stick out there, and he goes, and the dog goes, ah, you know. And it's really great. Now, I'm not saying, men, when you come home from work, that you ought to rub your wife behind the ears and throw a stick to chase now tomorrow. But you know, we speak so kindly to the family dog when we come home. Meanwhile, just grumble at the wife, you know, not willing to listen to anything she has to say, not offer her any kindness or any tenderness or any gentleness. You know, we're chummier to a parakeet in a cage and to a dog that wants to chase a stick than we are to the wife of our youth. Something sad about that. And some of you wondering why your marriage is not as happy as it used to be, or is not as happy as you thought it ought to be. It's because you're neglecting these little things. You're ignoring them. You're forgetting them. You're oblivious to them. And then thirdly, a man has the responsibility to provide. If he doesn't provide, he's denied the faith and is worse than the infidel. What are some duties of the wife? Well, there are some duties that the wife has. And of course, among those, not only is like the man, is to direct, the wife is to be in subjection under her own husband. But you know, that subjection of the wife is not a slavish subjection. It is not the kind that cowers before the master's boot. But she is a partner. She is a fellow sharer. She is an heir together of the grace of life. And she is to be one that serves out of love. One that is there to guide the house. That doesn't say a slave, but to guide that house. She's to be in subjection, but the kind of a subjection that is born of a relationship of love one to the other. Then secondly, the wife is to be to her own husband. She is to be a chaste and pure person to her husband. The Bible teaches that in Proverbs 12 and verse 4, that as a jewel of gold, Proverbs 11:22 says, in a swine's snout, so is a fair woman which is without discretion. The Bible says that a worthy woman is one that is of great value, but that one that maketh ashamed is as rottenness in his bones. Proverbs 12 and verse 4. And so then the woman is to be the center of the home as far as purity and splendor and beauty of character. And then the wife is to be a keeper at home. You know, many times people misread this text And they'll look at this passage and say a woman is to be a keeper at home. Now, what they read in this text as they read it is this. They think it says that here's what they're to do, that they're to keep her at home. Now, that isn't what the text says. The text says a woman's to be a keeper at home. Well, does that mean a woman can't have a job outside the home? Now, if the fact a woman does not have a job outside the home, if that means she is a keeper at home, if the very fact she has one means that she cannot be a keeper at home, then the fact that she doesn't have one would mean she is. And we know that's not so. Some women gallivant and gad about and talk on the telephone and window shopping and all kinds of different things running all over creation, and they're not taking care of the home. Don't have a job outside the home. But they're still not taking care of it just because they're at home all the time. You say, well, aren't there times when a person might have children a certain age or whatever that they shouldn't have a job out of the home? May very well be. But each individual case has to be judged on its own merits, you see. And I don't know what that limit is in your home. But ladies, whatever it is that keeps you from being a keeper at home is wrong to you. If it's soap operas, if it's just nosiness at going to every garage sale when you don't need something, if it keeps you from doing what you'd ought to do, it's a sin to you. Don't care what it is. But you need to marry to bear children to guide that house. Now, fine and last of all, let's talk about the duties of parents to children. What are some of the duties that the parents have to their children? Well, first of all, a neglected duty today is spiritual training. I'm persuaded, brethren, that one of the things that we're missing in our homes today is spiritual training. We have time to sit down. We have time to go over a history lesson and 20 or 30 math problems with our children. We're quick to see that they get their homework, but how many of you see they get their Bible class lesson for Wednesday night? How many of you help your child with their memory verse? Or how many of you Bible class teachers care anything about that? You see, do you help your children learn the books of the Bible? Are you teaching your children? Are you inculcating principles in their heart? And yet you have time to teach them history and math and English. These ought you to have done and not to leave the other undone. Why not? Sometimes people say, well, you know, I'm afraid if I make my child come to church all the time, I'll turn them against church. Well, it's funny it doesn't work in other areas. You know, there were two things I didn't like to do when I was growing up, a little boy. Didn't like to brush my teeth. Didn't like to take a bath. Until it discovered girls. That makes a difference. But you know, when you're a young boy, taking a bath is